Case number 22-5783, Sarah Hornburg et al. v. Shelby County, Tennessee et al. Or arguments not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. William R. Maurer for the appellants.
Morning.
Morning, Your Honors. My name is Bill Maurer. I represent the appellant Sarah Hornburg and Joseph Hansen in this case. And my first point this morning is that the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine does not apply in this case. And the most obvious reason that the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine does not apply in this case is that the plaintiffs did not ask the district court to review and reject any state court judgment. Even if plaintiffs were to succeed on every element of every claim set out in their First Amended complaint, absolutely nothing would change about any underlying judgment of the environmental court. Plaintiffs' claims for relief simply do not seek to undo any state court judgments. Instead, they want damages for constitutional violations. Specifically, they are asking the federal courts to consider whether the county and the environmental court violated their constitutional rights during the proceedings and whether they are entitled to damages for those violations. Those damages were caused by the county and the environmental court, not by the underlying state court judgments, if there were any. Under the Supreme Court's decision in Exxon, the holdings of this court, including McCormick versus Braverman and Van Hoven versus Buckles and Buckles, and the unanimous precedent from circuit courts around the country, this means that this case falls squarely outside the realm of the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine.
So, do you think, counsel, that you could ever have an action for damages that would be barred by Rooker-Feldman, or is Rooker-Feldman mostly confined to an appeal where, or a collateral attack on a judgment such that you're asking for some kind of equitable relief to undo or set aside the judgment itself?
Well, that's what the plaintiffs did in the RLR case, is that they sought an equitable judgment against the enforcement of the decision of the underlying state court.
Right.
So that, this court held, was barred by Rooker-Feldman. But if you're seeking damages for something that is unrelated to either the existence or the implementation of a state court judgment, that does not fall under the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine.
Yeah, I'm just wondering whether we should think about Rooker-Feldman by saying, you know, damages are just of necessity excluded because you're not asking to undo a state court judgment.
I think that's a reasonable interpretation of Exxon and this court's decisions interpreting the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. It is limited to asking the federal courts to reject a state court judgment, receiving damages for constitutional violations during a proceeding does not call into question the validity of the state court judgment, and so it would be outside of the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine.
Do you have to be for Rooker-Feldman to apply, do you have to have been a party to the state court proceeding? I mean, is that a requirement?
No, Your Honor. My understanding of the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, in the rare instances that it does apply, if you're a person who is asking for somehow the federal court to undo a state court judgment, that means that Rooker-Feldman applies. There doesn't seem to be a limitation on the nature of the plaintiff asking for that. Although I would think that most people who would
I'm kind of wondering if there is, because it talks about state court losers complaining about how the judgment hurts the state court loser. So if you're a state court loser, by definition, you are a party.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. I was thinking of the instances.
I mean, I don't know if you have any sense for my view of this doctrine, but it's not very positive, so you should be very happy about this from your perspective, and your friend on the other side maybe a little less happy. But I kind of thought what Justice Ginsburg was trying to say in Exxon and repeating in Skinner was, hey, the simple case, there are two parties in this state court. One wins, one loses. The winner usually doesn't sue to complain, so it's always the loser. And if it's not the loser complaining about the winner, that would be, so basically the same parties, it doesn't apply. So it's incredibly strict and narrow, it seems to me. So part of me thinks if it's not the exact same parties and it's the loser going after the winner for the hurt caused by the state court judgment, that's it. It doesn't apply.
I would agree, Your Honor. Where I misunderstood you was I there are circuit court decisions holding that people who are in privity with a state court loser may bring a Rooker-Feldman, may bring a challenge that is prohibited by Rooker-Feldman. That would, my understanding is that would fall under the universe of state court losers. And I think it's a good opportunity to point out that neither of the appellants here were state court losers. So privity or no privity, they simply did not lose any judgments below, and so there's nothing for them to attack, and so Rooker-Feldman does not apply for that reason as well.
How about an in rem action? So if the action were against the property, but you are the owner of the property, and you're going to state court to set aside an action foreclosing on the property, or would that party limitation apply in an in rem action?
And you weren't a party to the state court?
Well, you're not a party because the property was the party, but you're the owner of the property.
If
you don't answer quickly, I'm going to answer.
Okay.
I'm just...
your answers probably will be better than mine, but it will... I would imagine that in those circumstances, the person is not a state court loser, and so they would not have the Rooker-Feldman doctrine wouldn't be implicated simply because the proceeding was against the actual property as an in rem action.
Go ahead.
Moving off Rooker-Feldman for a minute, on your underlying claim. So the underlying action, as I understand it, is that the proceedings in the General Sessions Court were unfair in a lot of ways to your client. But you had to take a direct appeal because of this Tennessee Court of Appeals ruling that says you can't appeal it to the circuit court. But the reason for that ruling that the Tennessee Court of Appeals gave is because both courts, the circuit court and the General Sessions Court, have concurrent jurisdiction over these sorts of claims. So I'm wondering if there was a way, I mean, it strikes me as unusual that a case where there's concurrent jurisdiction over a claim, if a party is sued in a less favorable forum, couldn't move that to the circuit court where they would have more fulsome procedures, maybe a jury trial, I don't know what you get in circuit court in Tennessee, but is that available to your client? Is there some way to remove a case since they have concurrent jurisdiction?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. I don't specifically have the answer to that question, but I believe that when the environmental court exercises jurisdiction, in these particular proceedings, the environmental court's jurisdiction remains throughout the proceeding until it is finished.
Even though the plaintiff could have filed it in circuit court? So the plaintiff gets to pick the forum and you're just stuck with the forum that has less favorable procedures? That just seems odd to me.
I believe that's the way it works, Your Honor. I can research it and provide a follow-up letter to answer that question, though, with more definitiveness in the future.
Well, maybe I'm not following it, but it does seem indispensable. So it's your clients that are the ones sued, right?
Yes.
And so they're sued in, we'll call it the unfavorable court. If they can remove to the favorable court, that would just seem to make this whole case look very strange. Am I missing something?
They did not take advantage.
No, they didn't do it. I got it, but doesn't it seem quite important to know whether they could have? Because otherwise it's a self-inflicted harm.
Simply for the issue of the appeal, but I do not believe they had the option of removing it to the circuit court.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps my colleague has a better grasp of Tennessee state court procedure than I do.
It seems important.
Talk about the county's liability here.
Sure.
When you answer that, just assume away something you won't care for assuming away, but assume that the court is not a cognizable person for 1983. Just I get it that part of the reason we're having an argument is to debate that point, but I'm just kind of curious if that's true, and how's the county responsible for this?
Sure, absolutely. The constitutional violations here were attributable to the county for three reasons. First, the county established funds, invests its judicial power in the environmental court, and it acquiesced in the environmental court's repeated violations of due process against both of the plaintiffs and others who have appeared before the court. Moreover, the Tennessee Supreme Court, in an unbroken string of cases since 1960, has held that counties are responsible for the General Sessions courts, of which the environmental court is one.
The funding seems like a very tenuous theory to me, that the county funds something, therefore whatever happens, you know, it has individuals running it. It just seems very strange to me that the county's on the hook because they funded it. I don't know, intuitively doesn't seem right to me.
But that has traditionally been the main reason why the Tennessee Supreme Court has found that General Sessions courts are...
Yeah, so you're collapsing the two arguments. I'm assuming it's a state entity, and it's not a person and all that. And that's when I think your county argument starts to get weaker. Well, that's why I asked you to assume it.
I see. First of all, the environmental General Sessions courts are municipal courts. They're not state courts. And so they are created by the county. The county has the option of not creating them. The county vests its judicial power in these courts. And so it creates the entire environment under which the environmental court operates. So therefore, it is essentially giving birth to this.
Don't we have quite a few cases in the circuit suggesting similar courts are, quote, state entities exercising state judicial power?
But those are limited to cases in which the states themselves have recognized those courts as state entities. Here, the Tennessee Supreme Court has recognized that General Sessions courts are municipal entities and has done so for decades. I see my time is up. Is there any other questions?
I think there might be, so go ahead.
Well, I just want to make sure that I'm understanding what you're saying here. So the fact that they've been designated as municipal entities means that the cases and controversies coming before them are only and always pursuant to municipal ordinances and laws?
No, Your Honor.
I'll let you say that, but I'm going to have a follow-up for you probably.
Absolutely. The courts have recognized, starting with Durham versus Dismukes in 1960, the Tennessee Supreme Court has recognized that even though General Sessions courts do occasionally deal with issues of state law, they are primarily county entities, and the county is responsible for their actions. This has been an unbroken string of decisions from the Tennessee Supreme Court and the Western District of Tennessee.
But, you know, the question of what's a person, the question of when sovereign immunity applies, those are questions of federal law.
Yes, but they're determined by state law. Whether an entity, and this is the McMillian case from the U.S. Supreme Court, the question of whether an entity is acting as a state actor or as a municipal actor is determined by state law. And Tennessee state law is quite clear that General Sessions courts are municipal courts.
Can I ask one more?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm just having a little trouble understanding the underlying theory of your case. So you say that in the General Sessions court, you weren't given all of these procedures, rules of evidence didn't apply, couldn't cross-examine, you didn't have a record, so you couldn't appeal. And that led to a number of other harms down the line. But what I don't see in your complaint is any argument that the General Sessions Court reached the wrong decision, and that if you had had these procedures, they would have reached a different decision, or if you'd had a record, here's what you would have liked to appeal. So that just seems like a a problem in the chain of causation, right? Because if the environmental court gave you the wrong process but reached the right decision, I think we would say harmless error. If you weren't allowed to cross-examine a witness in a district court here, but the witness wasn't going to say anything useful, or there's no cross-examination you could have made, we would say, well, that didn't do you any harm. So I'm just confused. Like, what did you want to appeal? What did the environmental court do wrong?
Well, the issue here is whether they provided due process.
And but you can't have a procedural injury in vacuo, right? It has to have harmed you in some way, correct?
Well, they were subjected to the environmental court's lack of process from Ms. Hohenberg. She was subjected to it for 8 years. Mr. Hansen was subjected to it for 4 years. And the U.S. Supreme Court has held that when a that the violation or the lack of due process itself is a constitutional violation that is recognizable under Section 1983.
But I mean, if it took 8 years still to get to the right outcome, your point would be what, the extra fees and time?
It drove her into bankruptcy, Your Honor, made her lose her house. But the I would like to remind Your Honor,
time is long, too long as compared to what baseline? I mean, what? I mean, there's lots of litigation in this country that goes on for 8 years.
Well, I'd like to remind Your Honors that there was no outcome in this case. This case was dismissed because it was moot, because she had run out of money and had lost her house. And so there were ultimately, the process itself was the harm. It was the torment of going through that for 8 years, wiping out everything she owned, was in it itself a constitutional violation that resulted in massive amounts of financial disruption and psychological, and in Ms. Hohenberg's case, physical harm.
Well, maybe this is a good thing to think about for rebuttal, but just I still think it's a pretty important question. Was there a way to avoid this? And that's not obvious to me. Rules of evidence and process, it's not obvious to me. Had it been 4 years, a different set of rules of evidence, different set of procedures, it ends differently. That strikes me as the question you have to answer eventually.
That is a merits question, and it is one that I believe is our argument is consistent with well-established precedent, holding that subjecting someone to a process that is lacking in fundamental fairness is in itself a constitutional violation.
Okay, but if they'd used the rules of evidence, the thing would have gone faster? Is that your claim?
It would have been a fairer process.
Right, but you have two different claims. One, it was not fair, therefore I assume they reached the wrong result. One, it took too long. And I don't know how those two things connect up. I mean, we don't have a speedy trial claim. There's no Speedy Trial Act. I'm just having trouble connecting the various pieces of your complaint into one theory that says this is the thing that the environmental court or the county did wrong, and here's how it led to my harm.
I suggested you could do that in rebuttal. Yeah. Was what I was suggesting. So I wanted you to think about it, and we'll, as you can tell, we're not afraid to keep going if we need more answers. So thank you very much. We'll hear from the other side. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors.
Good morning.
I'm Chip Shockley from the Shelby County Attorney's Office, representing the defendant, appellee in this case. I think a good place to start is where we ended. What could the plaintiffs have done to avoid this? I think it's pretty clear that there were avenues of appellate practice that were actually filed here. Both parties filed appeals and then abandoned those appeals. I think that what the court is pointing out is that...
Are you talking about appeals here or appeals at this
state? No, Your Honor, in state court.
Yeah, right, okay.
What the court is pointing out is that there was at least 7 years of litigation by both parties in environmental court. And now environmental court is it's been described to me by its judges as a court of compliance. It basically wants people to bring their properties into compliance with local ordinances and to maintain safe and neighborhoods and the like. In both of these instances, these plaintiffs litigated for at least 7 years, made numerous court appearances, were represented by counsel, and in both instances, both plaintiffs filed appeals, but then neglected to pursue those appeals.
Well, they would say that's because they didn't have a transcript, so their appeal was futile.
Your Honor, the cases have shown many appeals have been taken from this very court, this environmental court of Shelby County, and the arguments that there was no record created simply they don't hold weight, because none of the courts in Shelby County, state courts, circuit court, provide a transcript. Now, litigants are able to bring recording or court reporters to any proceedings, including general sessions courts, to create a record, but they just didn't do so.
They could have hired their own court reporter.
Exactly. But even given that, though, the Tennessee Rules of Appellate Procedure provide a specific procedure for what to do when you don't have a transcript, and that is to create a record that can be evaluated by the higher court in Tennessee. Neither plaintiff here did that. That's not a deficiency. That's not a constitutional deficiency of the environmental court.
Can you answer my question about removal? So is there a way, if you're sued in this general sessions compliance court, and you're like, wait, I would like all the stuff you get over there in circuit court, rules of evidence, and maybe a jury, I don't know what you get. Can you remove it as the defendant?
No, Your Honor, not that I'm aware of. Now, there is an appellate pathway.
But they have concurrent jurisdiction, according to your Court of Appeals. The plaintiff can sue in either court?
That's correct. Under the Neighborhood Preservation Act, which Ms. Hohenberg's case...
Well, obviously the plaintiff's going to pick the one with fewer procedures. That just seems strange.
So what would have happened if they decided right from the outset, I've looked at how this worked, I've looked at the lax rules of evidence, I'm challenging it in this case. Could they have gone to circuit court and brought a constitutional challenge to the whole thing and tried to enjoin the compliance court, environmental courts?
Well, in the case of Ms. Hohenberg, she's the one that was sued under the Neighborhood Preservation Act that had concurrent jurisdiction with the state court. And so her avenue of appeal, which she pursued or attempted to pursue, was directly to the Tennessee Court of Appeals. She filed an appeal, two appeals to the Tennessee Court of Appeals, but then didn't pursue them. Mr. Hansen has a different pathway because his case fell under different statutes. His avenue of appeal would have been a trial de novo in the state, in the circuit court, and then from there up to the Court of Appeals.
Okay, so I'm getting on, but I'm just asking, in Tennessee, it's my property, they're about to invoke this process, maybe I'm already thrown in there. Aren't I allowed just to go to circuit court and bring a challenge to the validity of the whole statutory regime and say, stop this, it denies due process, and let's go forward with that, quote, constitutional claim, whether under federal or state grounds?
Well, Your Honor, I would actually argue that those constitutional challenges could have been brought in General Sessions Court. Our General Sessions Court is the primary court where criminal offenses start in Shelby County.
Okay, I just used the wrong word. So that's the Court of General Jurisdiction?
General Sessions Court, of which Environmental Court is one.
Okay, so you could have brought all these constitutional claims in that court in...
Correct, Your Honor, because criminal defendants bring those constitutional claims on a daily basis in that very court. That's how those are the main defenses argued by criminal defendants. So they could have been raised in the General Sessions Court. They could have then appealed to their appropriate places.
You couldn't have brought constitutional claims in the environmental court? I mean, you couldn't challenge the validity of the environmental
court? Not as an original claim, but attendant to these cases, yes.
But you could have said, you're not following the Tennessee Rules of Evidence, Your Honor. Please follow the Rules of Evidence. In that case?
You could. You could raise that issue, and then if it was declined, It could have been appealed to the next step, which again, both plaintiffs did, but just didn't pursue.
And for Mr. Hansen, you're saying his appeal was trial de novo in the circuit court, which
correct.
I think the circuit court is a court of general jurisdiction, correct?
Well, we have a general sessions court in both criminal and civil matters, which is where they have jurisdictional limits.
Yeah, $25,000. They do misdemeanors.
Right, and then the next level up is circuit courts. Now, under the Neighborhood Preservation Act, though, because the environmental court is exercising concurrent jurisdiction, the avenue of appeal is straight to the circuit to the Tennessee Court of Appeals. You don't get a trial de novo in the circuit.
But Mr. Hansen could have gotten a trial de novo.
Correct.
Today, but he didn't try to get one.
He tried, but then abandoned that appeal.
So. Did you, in this case, bring a claim preclusion defense on the theory that all of this could have been raised in the state courts, that's what claim preclusion is, and enough is enough?
I would raise that issue.
No, have you?
Oh, I have not. No, I have not. No. I do think it's important to look at what the environmental court actually did, because this question about... are the plaintiffs' claims here separate and apart from what happened from the claims in the environmental court? Are these 1983 claims different? And does that somehow make it not susceptible to a Rooker-Feldman bar? After the Exxon Mobil case, courts have determined it proper to, including this court, to examine the source of the injury alleged. And this court in RLR, just in 2021, made the statement that RLR would only prevail on its 1983 claims, as same as in this case, if the state court were wrong. So the order is the source of the injury.
But RLR, there was an order, you know, transferring the property to somebody else, and the complainant came in and asked the federal court to literally undo that order, to set that order aside and enjoin the transfer of the property. So it was literally asking to exercise injunctive powers to undo a state court order. That's
right.
Different, right?
That's true, Your Honor. But under this source of the injury test, what are the plaintiffs asking for here? And what happened below? What's the difference? Well, if you look at what the environmental court did, in the Hohenberg matter, the court made all sorts of judicial determinations. Now, counsel's correct, there was no final judgment. The cases were simply dismissed because they were moot by the time they ended.
Well, why don't we just stop right there? How can you be undoing a judgment in this setting? Because that's just not what this is about anymore. It was mooted?
Well, that's true, Your Honor. However, I don't, as the district court noted in this case, you can't rule on the plaintiff's claim. You can't evaluate them without stepping behind that and evaluating what the environmental court did in this case, because the environmental court made merits determinations. In the case of Ms. Hohenberg, it entered orders certifying that her property was a public nuisance, addressing receivership, auction.
They're not undoing the judgment. They're not, like, trying to say it's not moot, right? Exxon's 9-0. The court, you know, the greatest proceduralist they've ever had is Justice Ginsburg. She is so focused on this. And, you know, you want to go down source of injury lines, inextricably intertwined lines. You can make up anything if you're a good enough lawyer. And it's caused such chaos. Anyway, you can't be surprised to be hearing this from me.
I am not, Your Honor. Your reputation precedes you on your views on Rooker-Feldman.
What happened to Judge Mays? He's such a good judge. I want to know what Judge Mays said during the argument about this, because I have so much respect for him.
There was no oral argument, Your Honor. He ruled on the briefs.
I see.
And actually, our motion for judgment on the pleadings contained many arguments, and he picked this one, the Rooker-Feldman argument, to rule on. But below, we made several of the same arguments that you, Judge Larson, has pointed out about due process and what difference would it actually have made. And in addition, we've also made the arguments about how can the county be responsible for the acts in courtrooms of independently elected judges. again, in order to evaluate this case from...
Well, they say the funding is enough.
The funding is a matter of state law. All municipalities fund courts, provide courtrooms, courthouses, provide staff, that sort of thing, pursuant to state law requirements. That does not mean that the counties control what happens in those courtrooms. And in fact, they don't.
Is there a case? Do you have a case that makes that clear?
Well, the Shelby County Charter actually says Shelby County does not make draft rules of court.
No. I'm just hoping you had a case that clarifies you just can't have a causation problem. You have a serious causation problem when you're suing the county for things that a court did within that county.
Your Honor, I think this court in the Minner case held that a court is not a suable entity, which is...
But I mean, I think... Yeah, I just want to distinguish...
The county is.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we should talk a little bit about anything you want to say in response to their arguments about whether the court can be... Like, I got that one. But this is... Assuming you win on that, what's the case that says, hey, if you can't sue under 1983, the court... Not a person, sovereign immunity, whatever the explanation. You know, what happens when you try to sue the county instead, which, let's face it, does have a role here. Funding is not inconsequential.
Of course. I don't think there's a case directly on point, but I think it's important to note, as Your Honor points out, that municipalities aren't generally considered persons under 1983. This case is a 1983 case. That's what the claim the plaintiffs brought.
Well, the court isn't a person, but the county could be sued under 1983.
See Monell.
It could, if it controlled the things that the plaintiff complains of: application of rules of evidence, application of rules of civil procedure. The county does not control those things. Those things are controlled by independently elected.
Do they identify a Monell policy, right? You know where I'm going with the Monell point, right?
Sure.
Okay, so Monell does obviously show that 1983 you can sue counties. You wouldn't have Monell otherwise. But then it says you have to have, the county has to have been acting in connection with a policy, which right. is unconstitutional. What have they said? What is the unconstitutional policy here?
I would argue, Your Honor, that they have not pled a Monell claim adequately against the county. The only Monell claim that is...
Is Monell in the complaint? Did they say that in the complaint?
It's inadequate, Your Honor. The only Monell issue in this case is the maintenance of the court files, okay? And Judge Mays actually made the ruling that the plaintiffs in this case are actually complaining about their own mistreatment and don't adequately allege a pattern or custom for which the county could be held liable. And so on that basis, Judge Mays dismissed the Monell claim regarding the court files. Now, there is not a specific Monell claim, I would argue, about all of the other constitutional deprivations in this case. It just hasn't been made.
So you think they did not plead that by fund that they have a policy of funding the courts, or they had a policy of creating the courts, and that led to they have a policy of therefore failing to supervise that you'd say that's not in the complaint.
Well, Your Honor, I would again go back to the fact that the county doesn't control evidentiary rulings or procedure in.
Right, so you might be saying, well, they pled it, but it's just wrong.
Well, I would argue that they didn't adequately plead it under Monell anyway.
Well, they do. Go ahead. You probably found it.
Yeah, I mean, isn't what they plead that the county, and I'm not making any, opinion here as to whether or not this is sufficient, but what they say is that the county would routinely losing, destroying, or otherwise making court documents unavailable, and that is the policy that they say violates the Constitution.
Right. Judge Mays actually held that all they really said from a Monell standpoint is that they were mistreated because they couldn't get a hold of their own files, and there's long lines of case law that say that the plaintiff's own mistreatment isn't adequate. Not to mention, in this case, the court files containing over 1,000 pages were produced. So it's not that the court didn't maintain court files. Even on a motion for judgment on the pleadings in this case, Judge Mays could take judicial notice of the fact that there were over 1,000 pages of files over more than 7 years of litigation for both of these plaintiffs.
And well, did
you find 98? Are you at paragraph 98, or where are you?
Yes.
Yeah, so paragraph 98 says, Shelby County had a policy and practice of funding and failing to oversee and restrict the environmental court's violation of Ms. Hohenberg's due process rights, failing to require the court to follow Tennessee rules of evidence, civil procedure, failing to provide a forum for the consideration of constitutional questions. I think we've established that's not quite right. And then keeping records and transcripts. So I guess they are, I mean, that does look like it's pleading it.
Well, Your Honor, under this court's ruling in Thomas versus City of Chattanooga, a Monell plaintiff must prove that the county was involved in a clear, persistent pattern of illegal activity, which the county knew or should have known about, and then was deliberately indifferent to that, and then that the custom was the cause of the constitutional violation.
Is there any evidence of pattern here?
I would argue that there's not, Your Honor. Again, we're talking about these individual plaintiffs' mistreatment, which is not sufficient.
Well, two could be a pattern.
Under Monell, like Your Honor, I would say I would argue that two is not sufficient.
Okay. Okay. Well, I think unless you've got anything else, I think we're understanding your points.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Maurer.
Thank you, Your Honor. I do have an answer for your question about whether environmental court cases in certain instances can be transferred to other cases. If you look at paragraph 22 of the First Amendment complaint, it's also listed in the, hold on 1 second.
You said it's also listed where?
It's also referred to in the joint stipulated facts. Shelby County, Tennessee Ordinances, Section 10. I'm sorry, this is on page 584 of document 90, paragraph 38. The 14th Division has the same jurisdiction and powers as other General Sessions courts, as well as exclusive jurisdiction to consider, quote, alleged violations of environmental ordinances. That is Shelby County, Tennessee Ordinances, Sections 10-605.
Okay, except that the Tennessee Court of Appeals said the reason that you appeal to the Tennessee Court of Appeals instead of from General Sessions to the Circuit Court, which is the normal order of business, is because the Circuit Court and this Environmental Court have concurrent jurisdiction. So how can it be both concurrent and exclusive? How could that be? Somebody's wrong.
Well, since this is a municipal county court, the court is ruled by the ordinances created by the county.
So the Tennessee Court of Appeals is wrong to say that your appeal lies exclusively with the Court of Appeals?
I believe that is incorrect as a matter of...
Okay, but it's the Tennessee Court of... Tennessee has a unified court system, right? So that binds... I mean, unless the Supreme Court says otherwise, that's the law of Tennessee. I mean, they could be wrong, but I'm not going to tell them they're wrong.
Well, I think as a general matter, that entire decision is incorrect in both a statutory interpretation and as a constitutional matter. But the ordinances of the actual county, which set up and...
your harm. You need that Tennessee Court of Appeals case to be right, or else you don't have a harm, because you could have just gotten trial de novo in the circuit court.
Well, I mean,
you'd have rules of evidence and all the stuff you said it's a court of record. All the stuff you want is available in circuit court.
If it had been decided correctly, we would not have that claim in our case. But unfortunately, it was decided incorrectly, and we do have that claim. So we are required under the we are mandated to stay in the environmental court for violations of environmental ordinances by the county, and we are unable to go to circuit court per the county's rules.
I see. Okay, I'm sorry. I see what you're saying, and
take it the environmental court doesn't have, or does it have authority over criminal law?
It does.
It can be criminal.
Yes. It's Shelby County ordinances.
Right?
So why isn't everything that's going on here trying to circumvent Younger abstention, right? I mean, so what Younger suggests is that when you're in a court in any state where there's criminal stakes, if you don't like what's happening, you bring everything there. You know, if you think it's unconstitutional, whether in violation of the federal state constitution, you deal with it through the state court system. That really is the point of Younger. At a minimum, it's an implication because you can never challenge an ongoing proceeding by opting out and going to federal court and say, stop what's going on. So to me, that it suggests anything you don't like, you handle through state court, which to me would suggest that's where you should have done this, and not having done it, it seems like claim preclusion.
Two things, Your Honor. Three things, actually. Claim preclusion doesn't apply because the environmental court was not a party to the proceeding below. The environmental court was a third party, and that is who we sued. If we were suing the Neals, then there might be an issue of claim preclusion. There also wasn't a decision on the merits, so
it's not issue preclusion I'm talking about. I'm talking about claim preclusion, which is the doctrine that says you're not only barred from relitigating things you did litigate, you're barred from litigating things you should have litigated. And what I'm starting to think about this case is that, I mean, at everything in this case been just a straight-up criminal case. You know, your client, you know, sold some drugs or something. They're charged in state court. We know you couldn't have gone to federal court to stop that. And I would have thought your only avenue was whatever it is you don't like about what they're doing, process, you name it, you got to raise all those claims somewhere in state court.
Well, the simple fact of the matter was that there was no final decision in this case, and because there was ultimately no final decision, we did not have the ability to appeal the final decision. So the better metaphor, I believe, would be a criminal court where there was a hung jury. And there was no ultimate conviction or...
Go to federal court then?
Under Younger and under Rooker-Feldman. I would remind the court that the Tenth Circuit just earlier this month, held that Rooker-Feldman does not impose a duty to exhaust judicial and administrative remedies before pursuing a federal right, civil rights suit. Accordingly,
why are you thinking I'm making a Rooker-Feldman point?
I'm
talking about claim preclusion.
In order to have claim preclusion, you actually have to have an identity in the parties, and you have to have a final decision. And there was no final decision here.
But weren't there several orders that the environmental court entered against your client, various clients? You know, one of your clients was sent to jail for several days. There were various orders ordering, I think, Ms. Hohenberg to quit her property, to put her stuff on the lawn. And all of those you could have appealed. You filed some appeals. You abandoned the appeals. But, weren't those... I understand those aren't the orders that led to the demolition of the houses, but those were orders that led to some of the harms you allege here.
Well, the appeals would not have reached the issue of whether the county and the environmental court were financially responsible for the damages that occurred to...
Yeah, I got that.
...the defendants. I'm sorry, to the point, they were defendants below. And finally, with regard to the pleading... Your Honor correctly identified paragraphs 98 of our complaint as alleging policies. There's also at paragraph 152. I would also draw Your Honor's attention to paragraph 15 of our complaint, where we allege the ordinances creating the court and its judge passed by the Shelby County Board of Commissioners qualify as policies and customs attributable to defendant Shelby County, and we directly cite to Manel versus Department of Social Services and Owen versus City of Independence from the U.S. Supreme Court.
All right. Thanks so much. We really appreciate your briefs, and thanks for answering questions all over the map. These cases get so tricky, I got to tell you. 20 years in, and I every time I look at this, I'm like, what the heck? How does this work? So anyway, thank you. It's great to have good advocates. We appreciate it. Case will be submitted.